Good morning. This is Dan Arshak, and you're listening to the Criminal Law Show. It's a pleasure being here again. We broadcast the Criminal Law Show once a month, first Sunday of every month, at 11 o'clock in the morning. We address a whole variety of issues that are important to all of us who are involved in the world. If you read the newspaper, you read issues about criminal law. If you have friends and family, some of them are apt to be involved in the criminal law and criminal justice systems. I'm a criminal defense attorney. People sometimes ask me, how do you do that work, and why do you do that work? And you know, over time, I've given a lot of thought to what the right answer to that is, and it gets summed up in a song that I like to play at the beginning of the show. It's called Stand By Me. Take a listen.
No matter where you go in your life, at some point you're gonna need somebody to stand by you.
That's what criminal defense lawyers do. They stand by you.
Oh yeah, oh my darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you gonna need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got,
that song. And I really love it, really, because it sums up for me what it is a criminal defense lawyer does. If you ask any number of them why they do what they do, you'll hear a variety of answers. Some people talk about how important it is to uphold the Constitution and how important it is to see that someone has their rights protected when they get in court. And for me, really, it's just about standing next to a person when they're in a moment of need. And we stand by a person without question and without judgment. Whether they're guilty or they're innocent is really not an issue for a criminal defense lawyer. We stand by them. And when you need someone to stand by you, when your brother does, when your mother does, when your cousin does, it's going to be a criminal defense lawyer that you look to, and you're going to want that person to stand by them. That's what that song's about. That's what it means to me. And it has real relevance, I think, to the question of why it is criminal defense lawyers do what they do. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for, much too long, 38 years. I've represented thousands and thousands of people in my years. I worked for several years as a legal aid attorney in Manhattan. And I've represented wealthy people, poor people, and all variety of kinds of offenses that they've been charged with. And over the years, what's become completely apparent to me is the extraordinary degree of faith that we as U.S. citizens put in our criminal justice system. We walk around thinking we've got the best system in the world, and that if you're charged with a crime, you want to be charged with a crime in the U.S. because you're going to have the best shot at justice. I would have hoped, perhaps, that over the years that faith in this system would have been proven true. But the truth is that if you're alive and you have a heartbeat and you read the newspaper or listen to the news, you know that every day, all across the country, we're finding that innocent people are convicted on a regular basis, And it ought to cause us all to have real pause about what it is that's happening and how long this has been happening, why we're discovering it now, and really what we can do about the fact that that indeed innocent people get convicted day in and day out in our courts. We give a great deal of faith and credence to different sorts of evidence that we think is completely reliable. And for instance, we think that when somebody confesses, that's sort of the end of the story. But what we've learned over time is that innocent people can confess on a regular basis to things that they haven't done for a whole variety of reasons. Sometimes people are alleged to have confessed when they really didn't. Alternatively, we rely on eyewitness identifications. We think, well, if somebody can come into court and say, I saw that person do that thing, that's the end of the deal as well. But the truth is that we found that eyewitness identifications are some of the most unreliable kinds of evidence that can be admitted into court. And so over the time, as we've understood that these sorts of what we thought was incontrovertible sorts of evidence, while we've learned that that evidence is not incontrovertible and in fact is subject to all sorts of problems, there has grown up a number of lawyers who have decided to commit their practices and their lives to making sure that individuals who in fact are factually innocent but who have been convicted of offenses have a second shot. And our guest today is one of those lawyers. Some of you who listened to this show last month heard me have a wonderful discussion with the former Attorney General of Ohio, Jim Petro, a conservative Republican politician, who during the course of being the Attorney General became aware of the fact that a person in Ohio had been wrongfully convicted and tried to intervene on behalf of a person of that person. There, in fact, was DNA evidence establishing that the individual could not have committed the crime, and he met enormous resistance, even as the Attorney General of Ohio, to persuade, convince, and finally force a prosecutor to reverse track and get an innocent man out of jail. The kinds of evidence that typically is relied upon by lawyers who address these sorts of issues is DNA evidence, but what we know is that there is a whole world of kinds of cases that don't have DNA evidence. In fact, as my guests will tell you, the percentage of cases in which there is DNA evidence is very, very small. And so these lawyers and Glenn Garber, my guest who's waiting patiently on the telephone, dedicated to addressing those kinds of cases. Glenn has been a criminal defense lawyer for 22 years. I met him when our tenure at the Legal Aid Society Criminal Defense Division in Manhattan overlapped between 1991 and 1992. He does state and federal criminal trials and appeals throughout New York State, and he's currently in private practice. And after representing hundreds and hundreds of people, both during his years at the Legal Aid Society and in private practice, he founded an organization called the Exoneration Initiative. He's the founder and director. It was founded in 2009. He also teaches at Brooklyn Law School. He conducts a seminar on wrongful convictions and is a co-director of a clinical program called the Innocence Clinic, which is a follow-up to the Second Look program run by Pace University Law School. I'd like to introduce you to Glenn at this time, and I want to make sure I'm pushing the right buttons. Glenn, are you there?
I'm here. I'm here, Dan.
Terrific. I hope my introduction of you was accurate, and I know that our audience wants to understand really what drew you to this work in the first place.
Well, one correction on the intro is very good. The Innocence Clinic that I run is out of Brooklyn Law School, not Pace Law School.
Yeah, my error.
Not a problem.
Yep.
I think what got me into this work was my interest in or I guess my concern with the criminal justice system and how it was unfair to many criminal defendants, and the idea or the reality representing so many criminal defendants that some of these people are innocent, and if they are asserting innocence within the system, it becomes very difficult for that cry of innocence to be heard. And it's something that I guess was just working in the background of my mind throughout my 20 years or so of practice, and I wanted to do something about it. And I created this program, the Exoneration Initiative, to do non-DNA cases, the Innocence Project, which most people are familiar with, at least the initial, the starting program, the Innocence Project out of Cardozo Law School, is in Lower Manhattan, and they do DNA work. So I wanted to chip in where I could, and that's why I started to do non-DNA, which also put my skills to work. It's been a very gratifying run so far, and it's really just started.
And in fact, your initial foray into post-conviction relief for people claiming innocence was with the Innocence Project, with the Hector Gonzalez case, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about that case, Glenn.
Sure. In 2002, there was an individual named Hector Gonzalez, and in fact, he's the cousin of my secretary. And she had been telling me for a long time that her cousin was innocent, and hear claims of innocence a lot, don't know if they have any merit. And I started to look into the case, and it turned out that he was convicted in 1986 of a very brutal murder. Him and a number of other individuals were claimed to have beaten somebody to death and slashed him with razors and punched him, and it was a racially motivated attack. And as it turned out, the FBI had started to do an investigation into the case, and Hector Gonzalez, through the work really of the FBI in many ways, was found to be innocent in that many, many witnesses who later surfaced in the federal investigation claimed that he was just a bystander, which was his claim all along.
This was a case that was being prosecuted initially in state court by Charlie Hines, the district attorney of Kings County. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. And why were the federal authorities looking into it as well?
Well, it was a Latin King murder, and they were looking into the drug activity of the Latin Kings, and they started to rally around this homicide as one of their key offenses in a RICO prosecution, which was a sweeping prosecution to try to take down the Latin Kings. So they focused on this homicide that had been previously litigated in state court, and it became really the center of the federal investigation.
Well, before we move on to the federal investigation, what was the pieces of evidence that tied Hector, according to the Brooklyn District Attorney, to this homicide?
Well, it was a very weak case, and the key piece of evidence against him was one eyewitness identification. This was a friend of the decedent. His name was Lamille Cruz. That's the decedent. And the friend of his testified that he had picked Hector out of a lineup shortly after the offense had occurred, and that was primarily the trial evidence against Hector.
Well, you say that's a weak case, but what that means, isn't it, that somebody at the scene of the crime testified that they saw Hector commit the crime, and if I'm not incorrect, wasn't there also some blood evidence that the Brooklyn District Attorney put in against Hector, tying him to the offense?
Yes. There were blood spots on Hector's pants, and it was determined that the blood was consistent with the blood type of the decedent, and that coupled with the eyewitness identification became the evidence against Hector.
So you've got an eyewitness, and you've got the decedent's allegedly the decedent's blood on Hector's pants. And yet, you're calling that a weak case. Why do you think that's a weak case?
Well, I guess I'm saying that through my experience as an attorney who has not only done criminal defense work for a long time, but also innocence work. And we know that eyewitness identification can be fallible under certain circumstances, like those circumstances in our case. It was weak. And in particular, the friend of Lamille Cruz only had maybe, it was debatable, but maybe a minute to see this event under very stressful circumstances. The lighting conditions were very poor. and he had left and came back to get the police during this assault. And Hector was one of many Hispanic individuals who was rounded up at this near the scene and taken into custody and put in a lineup. So, you know, I say that it's a weak case because I think that is a weak identification, even traditionally, but filtering it through what we know about identification evidence, where many witnesses cannot make accurate identifications, studies have shown, and I think it's somewhere in a range of maybe 60% are accurate, 40% are inaccurate. I don't want to get into statistics too much because these studies can be debated on either side. But 75% of the DNA exonerations contain a component of false eyewitness identification. So I say it's weak for those reasons.
So in the Gonzalez case, the Brooklyn District Attorney stood up in court and said, we have an eyewitness, and now we know that the eyewitness identification was perhaps weak. But he also stood up in court and said, and we have blood, locking Mr. Gonzalez into his presence at the scene of the crime. But what did DNA evidence establish about that blood, Glenn?
Well, they tested the blood later on, and they found that the blood was not the blood of the decedent, so they excluded that piece of evidence. So then it boiled down to just the one witness identification and made the case that much weaker. But the exoneration was also founded on numerous eyewitness accounts who placed Hector at the scene but in the background as a mere spectator just watching and being nowhere near this assault when it took place.
When was Hector put in jail, Glenn?
He was put in jail in 1986.
And when was he finally released from jail?
He was exonerated in 2002.
6 years, 16
actually,
years.
Actually, no, I'm off on that. It's actually, it was 1996, I apologize. And he was exonerated in 2002.
Yeah. So 6 years of his life gone, and that motivated you to, that experience, participating in that case, motivated you to begin the exoneration initiative. What was your first case in that effort?
Well, I handled a case called People versus William McCaffrey. It was a Manhattan prosecution, and Will McCaffrey was convicted of a rape, a kidnapping, and an assault, sexual assault, that he didn't do, and was sentenced to 20 years in jail. And the key piece of evidence that exonerated him was I use terms like weak case, but I'll just get into the evidence here. The case boiled down to the testimony of Bernie Pagaro, who was the alleged victim of the rape. And there was no physical evidence that linked McCaffrey to any sort of rape. There was a rape kit done, and it came back inconclusive. So there was no evidence from the rape kit that showed, first of all, that she had been raped, and certainly that linked William McCaffrey to that crime. But what happened was he was convicted in 2005, and then in 2009, we started investigating the case in 2007, 2008. In 2009, Bernie Pagaro came forward to her priest. She was overcome by guilt, and she told her priest in confidence, later got revealed, that she had lied and manufactured the entire story and that she was never raped. But she was angry at her friends the evening of the incident and made up this story of rape in an effort to get their sympathy.
I thought that when people speak to priests, that's privileged and confidential and it can't get revealed. How did it get revealed in that case?
Well, what happened was her priest persuaded her to go to a lawyer, hire a lawyer, and come forward with her story because he wanted to have her right the wrong that she had committed. And that is how it got revealed publicly or to the DA's office. The statements that she made to her priest directly were never admitted. And by the way, there was an interesting legal question surrounding that because since she had revealed it inside and outside of the confessional, it wasn't all in the confessional, there was an interesting legal issue that we bandied about as to whether or not it was privileged, but we never had to untangle that because she had made the revelation to her lawyer and then to the district attorney's office, and then it was disclosed to us through our investigation.
But let's talk about that for a minute, because you were investigating what Mr. McCaffrey believed was his wrongful conviction well before you ever knew that the complaining witness had recanted her testimony, weren't you?
That's correct.
And in fact, you were engaged in trying to convince the prosecutor's office to reverse this conviction before they ever told you that there had been a recantation by the complaining witness, right?
That's correct.
So I'm sorry to push you on this, but when you first told me the story, my mind was just blown. You were working to exonerate this man during the same period of time that the prosecutor knew that the complaining witness had lied and, in fact, was prosecuting the complaining witness for perjury.
Well, they
didn't
they
come
were
forward and tell you that the first moment they learned that, did they?
No. I mean, I guess change that a little bit. They were investigating prosecuting her for perjury. But the timeline was this. There was some saliva found on the arm of Bernie Pagaro, and it was analyzed at the hospital when she came in after claiming rape. And at the time, this was 2005, they could not get enough biological evidence off of that saliva to get a DNA profile. So when we got involved, this is back in 2007, 2008, we focused right in on that DNA. And we were able to get it tested. And it turned out that there were profiles in the saliva, but there were no male profiles. McCaffrey was therefore excluded as a potential contributor to that saliva, and it was only female DNA. Now, the significance of that saliva was that Ms. Pagaro claimed that McCaffrey bit her during the rape. And since there was no other evidence but her word, that bite mark became central to the trial. So when we were able to get the DNA retested and show that it wasn't McCaffrey's saliva, we thought we won the case. Although it wasn't a slam dunk DNA case, you know, where there's semen, you know, found after a rape, and that semen is not the defendant's but points to somebody else, hopefully in the CODIS database, for example. It wasn't like that. What it did was it undermined the claim that McCaffrey had bit her during the rape.
Understood. So you walked into the district attorney's office with affirmative evidence that it wasn't his saliva on her arm and expected the district attorney's office to do the right thing. And instead what you learned was, well, you know, we've been investigating this complaining witness for perjury, by the way. And so I imagine at that moment they said, so we're going to make sure that Mr. McCaffrey is exonerated and released. They rolled over, isn't that right?
Well,
no?
I thought I was the knight in shining armor coming in with his DNA evidence, by the way, and I was rebuffed. But not only rebuffed by the district attorney's office, I had gone into court because we had to litigate the retesting of the DNA. They did not agree initially to retest the DNA. After about maybe a year of litigation, they did agree, and they consented to the test, and we got the results. We went back into court, and we thought that this was it. And the DA's office was resistant. We went to the court, and we thought the court was going to intervene and recognize the significance of this DNA evidence. And the court also had said, this is not enough. And we were then going back to the drawing board, and we started to do some more investigation, and then wound up getting information from one of Bernie Pagaro's friends who claimed that she thought she may have bitten Bernie Pagaro on the arm during a fight in the car, therefore bringing the DNA evidence to another level, significance-wise, as to that bite mark. And then we went into the DA's office with that, in addition to the DNA. And we thought at that point, look, they're going to concede this. They're going to say, look, we made a mistake. We're sorry. We agree. And it was going to be the end of the case. But we did not get that kind of reception. There was pushback. And then at a meeting, this is in May of 2009, I believe, they said, and by the way, Bernie Pagaro fully recanted her testimony.
By the way.
So my mouth,
your jaw had to hit the floor.
Well, my jaw hit the floor in the sense that I'm like, okay, now we have three powerful pieces of evidence that exonerate William McCaffrey. The third coming from you, which completely eradicates the case because it was founded on the testimony of this one eyewitness, this one witness claiming rape. So let's call this a day, and let's join in an application to the court to request that the case be dismissed and he be exonerated.
So it had
and that is not what happened.
You mean to tell me that the prosecutor didn't walk over to the courthouse and open up the jail and let Mr. McCaffrey out?
Hardly. What happened was what happened was they said that they needed to investigate. And here McCaffrey is languishing in jail. It's about 4 years of incarceration that he's suffered by this point. And they needed to do what they claimed to be a thorough investigation. And it went on.
Was that the same kind of thorough investigation that we expect prosecutors to do before they charge people with crimes?
Well, you would if you look at it from a juror's perspective or an outsider.
Let me just stop you for a second because, frankly, I don't look at from it from either a juror's perspective or an outsider's perspective. I look at it from the same perspective that I think all of our listeners look at it from, and that is that at any moment, every single one of us could be swept up wrongfully in an investigation. And we would expect the prosecutor's office and the police to bring all of the same sorts of pressure to bear in deciding whether we ought to be charged with a crime as they finally do after they have evidence proving innocence. Isn't that the sort of investigation that we expect and want prosecutors to do at the beginning of a case?
Well, when you say we, and maybe I'm jaded because I've been doing this for so long.
Well, you and me,
well,
and everyone who's listening to us, and our children, and our parents, and their brothers and sisters, we.
Well, what I'm saying, though, Dan, is that the standard for probable cause is very low. The standard to obtain an indictment is very low. And so people can be swept up on very flimsy evidence and the investigations are not as thorough as they should be. And it's
so
let's
just put a little finer point on that, Glenn, because you and I know what these terms mean. But when you say the standard for probable cause, what you're referring to is how much evidence do the police need in order to arrest a person?
That's correct.
And the standard for that is that they have a reasonable basis to believe that a crime has been committed and that the person they want to arrest committed it. Just a reasonable basis. That's all they need.
Yes.
Right. And in order for a grand jury to issue an indictment, how much evidence is needed? Well, we know that the standard for that is more likely than not. It's just more likely than not. The grand jury listens to the evidence and they say, well, we think it's more likely than not that a crime was committed and this person committed it. And that gets somebody indicted, isn't that right?
That's right. And the investigations that take place prior to that indictment and even after the indictment are not as thorough as you would think. They're not looking to dispel any piece of evidence that could exonerate somebody. And there are a lot of times they're just dealing with the word of one witness. And they're in trial prep mode for a lot of that time period after the indictment, trying to make that witness as strong as they can be so that they don't get destroyed on cross-examination. And when you scrape it all away, really all you have in this case in particular is the word of one witness. And that was it.
Right, right. Horrifying. And
maybe back to your other question, there's a double standard here because what happens is the depth of the investigation before conviction is not always that intense or that in-depth. But once you have a conviction, once a jury has spoken, there is so much emphasis in the system placed on the conviction that the finality of that conviction is protected by the prosecutor's office, as they should be in many cases, by the way. And then when you're asking them to exonerate somebody, undo that conviction, they will take it to another level. and their investigation or their proof that that person is innocent has to be at a much. And I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying from their perspective, and this is what I believe to be their perspective. It has to be on a much higher level.
Higher level than what?
What the evidence was to convict.
No. Let's talk.
The
about
evidence
this.
To exonerate.
I'm going to interrupt you here because. Yeah. Yeah, you know, you and I have been doing this work for a long time, and so we know terms like standards of proof. So we know that there's different levels of standards of proof. In a civil case, when someone sues someone for breaching a contract, the person who wins is going to be the person who presents the preponderance of evidence. It's 51% wins. In some cases, there needs to be something called clear and convincing evidence, which is more than a preponderance of evidence. But the highest standard of proof that we have in our country for anything is beyond a reasonable doubt. There isn't any higher standard of proof. That's what jurors in criminal cases are instructed that they need to find in order to find somebody guilty. So when you say that the prosecutor takes it to a higher standard of proof, ain't no higher standard of proof than reasonable doubt.
That's true.
What higher standard do they need?
I'm talking on a practical level. The way they, at least in my experience, the way they respond to claims of innocence after conviction. There's no standard that I could articulate. What I'm saying is there's resistance in district attorney's offices to admit they made a mistake.
That's
where I'm going with this. I'm not comparing it to the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard that a jury is called to answer at a criminal trial.
So what happened to the presumption of innocence? Where does that work into this process? People always refer to the presumption of innocence as being that thing that protects our brothers and uncles and fathers and sisters from being convicted of crimes that they haven't committed. What happens to that? How does that work in the mix?
I don't think it has any significance in this context. The presumption of innocence is a rule of law to be followed by jurors so that they're not soured against an accused until they've heard all the evidence and they've deliberated and considered it and found that it's overcome by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the only context in which I think it applies. It certainly doesn't apply in the minds of prosecutors and law enforcement because they're looking at standards like probable cause and they're preparing a trial. And even as to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I think a lot of prosecutors would say, if I don't believe that there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm still not going to dismiss a case. I'm going to allow the jury to decide whether or not that standard has been met. But in the post-conviction context, once you're asking them to undo a conviction, the standard is so high. It's not a legal standard. It's a practical standard. They want to know with almost a degree of absolute certainty that this individual is innocent before they will take action and come into court and say, we made a mistake. And there's a number of reasons why I believe they do that. And it's wrong, obviously, and it's a big problem for the work that we do. But it is very difficult for people that the public holds in high trust to admit they made a mistake. It rocks to the foundation of our criminal justice system, and it diminishes the reputation of those district attorney's offices that prosecute those cases. Their political problems for DAs who need to be reelected, and the last thing they want to do is say, we made a mistake. This individual who we got a 20-year sentence on was innocent. It's hard for them to do it.
I get that it's hard. I get that it's difficult for a professional to acknowledge that somehow there was a failure in the system before them, though it's often not the prosecutor who's reviewing the case who may have been responsible for convicting an innocent person. But I would think that the overriding concern, the single overriding concern for any prosecutor would be that at some point, having convicted an innocent person, they would have to look at their child and say, yes, you know, I participated in making sure that a human being spent 20 years in jail for a crime that they didn't commit, and then I fought against getting him out. And I think that there would be this you know, call me naive, but I think that there'd be this sort of connection to humanity that would compel a human being to assure that if there's the slightest chance, we might want to call it a reasonable doubt. If there's a slightest chance that an innocent person is languishing in jail, that they would jump over backwards trying to figure out how to make sure that they haven't played a role in incarcerating an innocent person. What, Glenn, you've talked a little bit about that, you know, there's an embarrassment factor in why a prosecutor might not rise to the occasion and do the right thing. Are there any other issues that you think that stand in the way of prosecutors doing the right thing? I see news all across the country of these second look bureaus that are set up in prosecutors' office. I know Manhattan has, since it elected its new district attorney, set up a second look bureau that's supposed to look at cases that where questions of actual innocence have been raised, and I'm curious, you know, how many cases they've reversed since they started doing that.
Well, the district attorney's office integrity unit, this is in Manhattan, this is Cy Vance's office, is supposed to look at cases where they believe wrongful convictions have occurred and to take action on their own to exonerate those people. And this unit has been in place, I guess, approximately 2 years, and I'm not aware of any exoneration that they've advanced. So in my mind, I think the jury is still out on that particular unit. I think it's a great idea. I think prosecutors' offices should have them. And but as far as Cy Vance's is concerned, I think that the jury is still out on it. There was a program, or there still is a program, in Dallas called the Conviction Integrity Unit. And Craig Watson, who is the district attorney in Dallas, has created a very unique unit in that I think that when he came into office, this is in the early 2000s, there was a mandate to clean up a lot of the corruption in Dallas. And he had appointed a criminal defense attorney, in fact, to head the unit. His name was Michael Ware. I think Michael Ware, by the way, has been relieved of that post this year. But in any event,
a little too effective, perhaps?
Well, I think what happened...
How many exonerations did they have since Mr. Ware was involved?
I think there was about 21, maybe more, exonerations. Most of them DNA. Yeah. And I think what happened, and this may get to the point that you were making, what happened was the DNA exoneration started to wane a bit. They went down. And that is probably, and I don't know enough about why Mike Ware left to answer this question fully, but that may have been the reason why he left his post, and that unit may be on the rocks to some extent now. But in non-DNA cases, and they've had a number of non-DNA exonerations in Dallas too, they're very complicated. And the evidence that is used to exonerate is similar to the evidence that was used to convict. And sometimes it's more. You may have multiple witnesses saying that person wasn't there, as opposed to the one that was used to convict that person. But I think when prosecutors are looking at that evidence and they don't have the magic DNA bullet that says, look, we can't refute this, when you're dealing with witnesses, it becomes evidence that can be challenged. And people say, well, look, this witness that came forward to exonerate this individual has a criminal history. Or this witness, you know, may know the defendant. And I think that those types of discussions ensue in prosecutors' offices when you're coming forward with exonerating evidence that is not DNA evidence.
But Glenn...
I'm sort of defending them to some extent.
No, I hear you. And
it's just because I want to be balanced here. And by the way, I'm outraged by the way they handle these cases.
I don't have any interest whatsoever in being balanced. If there's a single innocent person sitting in a jail in New York State, I think our attorney general ought to be jumping over backwards trying to make sure that this guy or this woman gets out of jail. This isn't a cause for balance. It's not like reasonable minds can disagree about whether an innocent person ought to be in jail. No. The moment that there's a concern, a real concern about an innocent person being in jail, alarm bells ought to be going off. And instead, what we have is the protection of prosecutors' reputations. And I just personally, I find that to be horrifying. And look, Glenn, I know you're trying to be balanced, but I know you find it horrifying as well. And that's, of course, that's why you do this work. Can you shed a little bit of light on what sorts of issues and how frequently those issues arise that cause wrongful convictions?
Certainly. We're fortunate because now we have a body of information that's developed since 1989. So you're talking about over 20 years people have been studying DNA exonerations. The movement really started in 1989 with the Innocence Project. And professors of law studying criminal law have broken these cases down and have looked at the causes of wrongful convictions. And what we're finding is that most of the wrongful convictions contain an element of erroneous eyewitness identification. And the percentages that are placed on it by the Innocence Project are 75%. So 75% of the 273 DNA exonerations contain false eyewitness identification.
So let's just be clear about that. So these are cases in which we now know that the defendant was factually innocent. We know that because DNA says so. And so there can be no dispute but that those people didn't do the crime. And when you look at the evidence that convicted those people, 75 out of 100 of them were convicted on the basis of an eyewitness who said that guy did it.
Correct.
Let's back off of that a little bit, just once. I'm sorry for interrupting you.
But that's okay. I interrupted you, too.
But I get to control the microphones here, so I've got an advantage. So those are in DNA cases. We can do that. We can establish that frequency in DNA cases. And is there any reason to believe that that frequency of people who claim innocence in non-DNA cases is any different than in DNA cases?
Absolutely not. I mean, logic demands that it happens with the same frequency in non-DNA cases. You just don't have the exonerating DNA to bring to the attention of prosecutors and courts.
So it's not as though every single person who gets, despite what popular culture says, they talk about everybody in jail says they're innocent. That, of course, as we know, isn't the case. Those people who contend that they're actually innocent and who are determined to be actually innocent, 75% of the time it's based on eyewitness identifications that were simply false.
In whole or in part, there's a component of that in 75% of the cases.
Understood. And don't a lot of the people or some significant portion of people who are convicted of those crimes and end up getting exonerated have actually confessed to the crime, isn't that right?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, this is a fascinating area, false confessions, because it's counterintuitive to believe that somebody would say they committed a crime that they, in fact, did not commit. 25%, by the way, of wrongful convictions, the DNA wrongful convictions, are founded in whole or in part on false confessions. So that's a huge number. So you're talking about people coming in and giving convincing stories, by the way. I study these tapes because what the police will sometimes do is they will interrogate somebody for a very long period of time, and then they will only tape the last hour or so of that interrogation. And that is, so it's really gone through a dress rehearsal, although frequently they will deny that that's what happened. And the jury will see what is a very powerful piece of evidence, which is the individual stating that they committed the crime, sometimes with graphic detail. And what blows your mind, or what blows my mind about about the DNA exonerations and the false confessions, is we know that individual came in, gave a detailed, convincing story about how they committed the crime, and we know that they didn't commit the crime. It is something that people have trouble wrapping their head around. And there's a movement now in the criminal defense bar to allow allow expert witnesses on false confessions testify before a jury, so a jury can learn more about this phenomenon and can put it into context and understand it better.
Well, something that I have some familiarity with, the ability of the defense in a case to bring in an expert witness, even on an issue like eyewitness identification, which has been proven in thousands of studies in the last 15 years to be incredibly prone to failure. Defense attorneys are precluded in almost every jurisdiction. There's some exceptions, and it's growing, but they're still precluded in almost every jurisdiction from calling scientists to explain to jurors what the problem is with eyewitness identification. Isn't that so?
That's so. And we've made some headway in New York under People versus LeGrand because we can bring in an expert if the eyewitness identification is the sole or primary evidence against the defendant. If there's other pieces of evidence against the defendant, then courts in their discretion can say, well, it's not that important, the eyewitness identification in this case, although it may be, and you're not allowed to bring in an expert. So there's limits. But that, by the way, is a huge step in the right direction. The fact that we're even able to bring experts in eyewitness identification cases, even if it's a limited set of cases, that's a great step forward. False confession experts have not reached that level, and there's resistance.
Right. So these sorts of infirmities in the kinds of evidence that is introduced against defendants includes this eyewitness identification problem, the problems with false confessions.
There's more.
Right. I mean, we know, that we ought to look skeptically, for instance, on testimony from people who have something to gain by lying, like snitches.
The terminology that we use in the field is snitch or incentivized witness testimony.
Right.
Somebody who has a motive to give false testimony.
That ought to be looked upon skeptically, and people understand that. But what perhaps people don't look so skeptically upon, because we're bombarded with it on shows like CSI and Law and Order, are all the pseudoscience techniques that are used to, determine that the thread that's found at the scene could only have come from the defendant's mother's rug, the tool mark made by the weapon that went into somebody's body could only have come from a particular weapon that was owned by the defendant. What about this kind of pseudoscience?
Well, the terminology we use is junk science, and that is a situation where a expert will testify for the prosecution on areas similar to what you're saying and others, and say that, this science proves that the defendant was at the scene, for example. And a lot of these sciences have been debunked. And, I think the arson science is the most stark example. They would look at burn patterns in rooms, and they would say, because of the burn patterns, we know that an accelerant or gasoline, for example, was spilled on the floor, which is a telltale sign of arson. And that burn pattern conclusion that was asserted by many experts to cause people to get convicted of arson, we know is untrue. And there can be a variety of reasons why there may be certain burn patterns that don't relate to accelerants. So there are many people who were convicted of arson, which obviously is a very serious crime, and when people die, it's murder, and they were their convictions sometimes are based exclusively on that expert testimony, which is false.
Sure. I understood. We've got arson problems, we've got tool mark problems, we've got ballistic problems, the notion that 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 anybody can determine that a particular bullet came from a particular gun is La La Land. And it's only La La Land because nobody has looked at all the guns to be able to determine that that bullet coming from that gun excludes all the other guns in the world. It's you know, DNA is scientifically based, and very little other evidence is actually scientifically based. And what I hear you saying is that it ought to be looked at extraordinarily skeptically by our community when they're presented with that kind of evidence by prosecutors.
I also think that courts should take challenges to the admissibility of certain scientific evidence more seriously.
You know, I love that you raised that, and I'm sorry again for interrupting you, but you reminded
me,
there's a wonderful, wonderful judge, a federal judge in Massachusetts, Nancy Gertner, who unfortunately is retiring from the bench, who, when it became apparent that in the past several years that that the underpinnings for all of this junk science, all this pseudoscience, was likely resulting in many, many innocent people getting convicted of crimes, made it a rule in her courtroom that at any point that the prosecution decides to use some sort of scientific analysis in a criminal prosecution, the defense is obligated, must test the credibility of that science. And if they elect not to, they have to state in no uncertain terms why they've decided not to. It's a common sense rule when you're presented with people who are just making things up year after year. Glenn, we're soon going to be running out of time. We've got about another 6 minutes to go. And I want you to tell us about the exoneration initiative, your mission, and who you try to help and how you do that. What's the process?
Okay. Well, the Exoneration Initiative is an innocence project, a non-DNA innocence project, that helps inmates in New York who we believe or claim to be actually innocent. That doesn't mean that there's some technicality that we could point to get them off, but they are actually or factually, those words are synonymous, innocent. They did not commit the crime. And so what our mission is to exonerate the actually innocent. We also try to educate the courts, prosecutors, and the public about the fallibility of the criminal justice system. And we advance doctrinal law. We try to make the law better, post-conviction law specifically, so that people who claim innocence can get their day in court, because there's a lot of resistance legally to bringing up old cases. So those are the three missions. Now, what we do is we serve the New York State prison population, and we are overloaded with requests for assistance.
Well, I can't imagine. How many do you get? How many requests do you get?
Well, there's 57,000 inmates in New York right now. We get dozens of requests every month. We've gone through probably about 3,000 cases. And we are constantly reviewing cases to determine whether or not they have merit. It's a monumental task, by the way. We starts out with letters from an inmate saying that they're innocent. And sometimes the letters are detailed, and we determine whether or not we think it's a legitimate claim of innocence. If it is, and on its face, by the way, without scrutinizing it too much, we send out a questionnaire, which is a 12-page questionnaire designed to break down the case so that we could determine whether or not it is a potential innocence case. And then if it passes that level of scrutiny after the questionnaire is reviewed, we will ask the inmate to supply court documents. And because we're a small organization with limited funding, we try to cherry pick the documents that we think are going to enable our analysis at that early stage, appellate briefs, sometimes affidavits from witnesses. There might have been a post-conviction proceeding that the inmate had lost. We may want to review some documents from that. And then we continue through. And if it gets past that stage, we'll ask for more documentation. We may visit the inmate. We may invest resources and do an investigation. And ultimately advance the cases to a litigation-worthy posture. Then we would file a motion for that individual in court seeking their exoneration. We may
How's all this I have to imagine that most of the people who ask for your assistance are indigent, don't have money to hire a lawyer. How can you afford to do this?
Well, we work off of grants. We have pro bono assistance. We have a judge, a retired judge from Brooklyn Supreme Court, who had been doing criminal work for 30 years, who assists us pro bono. Her name is Ann Feldman. She's unbelievable. We have Rebecca Friedman, who is the assistant director of the program, who worked for us for 9 months pro bono, and now is in a paid position due to some grant monies that we got. We get donations from private practitioners and other people who are familiar with the work we do and who feel committed to assisting us with donations. We certainly don't have enough money to do what we need to do, but we make our way. We also team up with law firms, and they provide us with pro bono assistance. In fact, we're in the middle of a trial right now in White Plains, where I've co-counseled with lawyers from Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, and they put their firm behind the case, and I'm working with
Glenn,
a lawyer.
Before we run out of time, which is going to be in about a minute and a half, okay. I want you to...
talking faster, knowing we're getting to the end here.
But I'd like you to let us know what your email address is so that people can reach out to you if they'd like to donate or get more information.
That's great. First of all, you can go to the website, which is exi.org, and my email is ggarber, which is G-G-A-R-B-E-R, at exi.org.
Glenn, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time on the Sunday morning. I think this is an incredible issue. I know that you're doing God's work, and I hope you have all the success in the world going forward.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, and thanks for having me on, Dan.
You bet. Take care. This is Dan Arshak. I'm going to sign off now with a little song that you can listen to that will remind you about why it is that defense attorneys do what they do.
No matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.